A mutant coronavirus has emerged, even more contagious than the original. US scientists warn of the emergence of a mutant, more contagious strain of the coronavirus. By now, many of you might have come across these sensational headlines from the LA Times to a host of global and now Indian publications. They reference a preprint publication by a consortium of scientists led by the Los Alamos National Laboratory that was uploaded on BioArchive on April 30th. Meanwhile, scientists Partho Majumdar and Nidhan Bishwas at the National Institute of Biomedical Genomics near Calcutta in India had submitted their study with similar conclusions to the Indian Journal of Medical Research, IJMR, and their paper had been accepted after review just a few days before the US study came out. Instead of getting lost in headlines, here on the Pragati podcast, we take an in-depth look at how the SARS-CoV-2 virus has mutated and evolved since it started infecting humans in Wuhan in late 2019. We look at what the latest research can tell us about the A2A subtype of the SARS-CoV-2 virus that has become more common across COVID-19 cases since March and April, and what its defining mutations may mean for our understanding of the virus biology and the pandemic. Partha Majumdar, one of India's foremost researchers in statistical genomics and human genome variation, joins me on the Pragati podcast this episode to talk about all this and more. Hi, I'm Pavan Srinath and welcome to the Pragati podcast. I'm here today with Dr. Partho Majumdar, distinguished professor and founder of the National Institute of Biomedical Genomics in West Bengal. He's also the president of the Indian Academy of Sciences. Dr. Majumdar is joining me today to discuss what we know so far about the SARS-CoV-2 virus, how it is mutating and evolving since it started infecting humans in about December 2019 or so. We'll be discussing the science, the result of his own research, questions researchers are still seeking answers to, and more. Dr. Majumdar, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
We are recording this indoors on May 4th, even as I hear stories of people rushing to liquor stores in Bangalore here that have opened for the first time in 6 weeks. So it's an interesting time that we are recording this for sure.
Yeah. Yes.
And Dr. Majumdar, I've read your research and I've attended talks by you on how humans have evolved and how human ancestry has progressed as well. So this human evolution happens perhaps in the tens of thousands of years, right? If not even longer.
Yes.
But viruses like the SARS-CoV-2 virus mutate and evolve incredibly quickly, right? Perhaps within the span of one infection of one patient. Since your research spans all these very different timescales, can you help us understand how to think about mutation, change, and evolution?
Essentially, it's the same phenomenon that drives the evolution of viruses or fast-evolving organisms compared to slow-evolving organisms such as humans and other larger animals. The viruses, of course, evolve extremely fast, in particular the RNA viruses, of which SARS-CoV-2 belongs to that class of viruses called RNA viruses. RNA viruses evolve fast because they do not have the so-called proofreading ability. So when the virus is multiplying, when the virus is from one virus, we get two copies of the virus, the RNA actually needs to replicate. And when the DNA replicates, there is an enzyme that helps replication, but that enzyme also has a proofreading ability. So, for example, if you're copying from a book, after we write it down on another piece of paper, we read that paper back to find out whether we have made spelling mistakes or whether other kinds of copying errors have happened. So that's called proofreading. The RNA viruses have a specific kind of protein that helps it replicate but has no proofreading ability. So copying errors persist, and these copying errors are essentially what these mutations are. With respect to SARS-CoV-2, the estimate is that it is, like you correctly pointed out, it's evolving at a very fast rate in a short span of time. And the estimate of the mutation rate for SARS-CoV-2 is about 2 mutations a month.
Okay, so that is 2 mutations after selection processes and sort of the evolutionary pressures that come in, right? The question I sort of always have is, supposing you have one virus particle that infects one human cell and it creates millions, if not hundreds of millions of copies just as it exits the cell. Are there mutations that happen right there? Like if one copy becomes, a million fold, will there be errors just in that one infection?
Very interesting question. And absolutely. What you said is absolutely right. So here, evolution takes place at kind of two levels. One is within the host. So viruses are not living entities. They can't live by themselves. They need a host. They need another to get into another organism, either a plant or an animal, for their own living. So they get into a host cell. So now there are really two ways evolution is happening. One is across individuals, which is the normal thing that we see, that one individual reproduces, produces offspring, and so on and so forth. So over generations, mutations happen, and that's the time scale of evolution that we are normally attuned to.
Right.
That's one mode that they will mutate and evolve, but there's also a huge amount of evolution that takes place within the host, within the individual in whom the one copy has gone in and is making hundreds of millions of copies. So there again, the scale of evolution is at two levels. And absolutely, you're right that even within a human, within a host, there is evolution that's going on.
So in that sense, I think even in your paper, you talk about this conception of something called phylodynamics, yes, where evolution happens in the same time scale as epidemiology and just infection within a human, which makes it fundamentally perhaps difficult, more challenging, and just more difficult to understand than conventional evolution that happens at a very different time scale, right?
Yeah, so the scale of evolution is usually per generation. We measure mutations per generation.
Okay.
Which is oftentimes translated to a time scale because generation time of different organisms are different.
Right.
So oftentimes we actually calibrate that from mutation rate per generation to mutation rate per year so that we can compare mutation rates across species, because different species have different generation times. With respect to viruses and such, how does one define a generation is itself nebulous. So like you correctly pointed out, and like I said, that it's happening at two levels, across humans that are being infected and within a human who is infected. So there are essentially two processes that are simultaneously going on. So defining mutation rate per generation becomes difficult. And it also becomes difficult to detach the two. So it's a confounded mutation rate that one calculates. And that's how we've calculated that this particular virus, the SARS-CoV-2, is mutating at the rate of two mutations per month.
Okay.
And it's calibrated against time. So it's that's the mutation rate that's going on.
Okay. Could you also give us a sense of the kind of evolutionary pressures that this virus could face that drive the selection of these mutations? Because as you mentioned, the mutations happen randomly because of proofreading errors. But what drives evolutionary pressures in terms of conserving a gene sequence, a DNA sequence, or an RNA sequence versus changing the same thing?
So it's as far as we can tell, it's quite possible that there are other phenomena that also operate in viruses, but we haven't discovered any other kind of phenomenon other than Darwinian natural selection by survival of the fittest. The fit viruses will have a survival advantage, and they are the ones who will spread through a population. So it's again survival of the fittest and natural selection that operates.
And so here there can be sort of positive and negative pressures, right? Certain
yes.
parts where if something gets mutated, the virus can't function, can't invade a human cell, can't replicate, something goes horribly wrong.
Absolutely.
Like a lethal mutation. So those sites sort of stay conserved, right? And we can detect that over time as to which regions are more important for the virus to just survive and continue doing what it does. And some places where perhaps mutations give it an advantage of some sort.
Usually, the regions that are conserved are the regions that are necessary for the viruses, for the virus to replicate or whatever, some essential function of the virus. Those regions have become so efficient that they don't usually tolerate any mutations, because any mutations in those regions will destroy or reduce the efficiency of that particular essential function. Those will be the regions that are conserved across different classes of viruses or different types of viruses belonging to the same class. However, there are regions where, for example, in this particular virus, there's a region called the spike protein, which is mutating. And most of the time, these mutations, whatever mutation takes place in these regions, they will probably go away from the population because most mutations are going to be deleterious. Most mutations, like in other species, will reduce the survival advantage of the individual. And so they are called deleterious mutations, in which case they are eliminated quickly from the population. However, those mutations that provide even a slight survival advantage compared to the pre-existing varieties of the virus will actually propagate through the population more efficiently, sometimes even outcompeting the other viruses. And that's one of the things that we've been able to discover with respect to SARS-CoV-2.
Thank you so much for helping us think through that and understand that. So, and I want to come to your latest study, and I'm delighted that I got a chance to read your preprint at length before having this conversation. So now we know that the SARS-CoV-2 virus has about 30,000 bases of its RNA. And in this 30,000 long RNA strand, we know that the virus that started infecting people in Wuhan and China perhaps didn't cross over to humans from its reservoir too long before it was detected. And you have labeled this as the O or the ancestral type of this virus. So could you tell us about how you went about in your study looking at this virus that started infecting humans and how you have tracked its evolution and its mutations till the end of March?
Let me step back because you asked me to talk about how this virus evolved.
Right.
As you correctly pointed out, that the virus was first reported from China and was never ever reported prior to that. So we assumed that whatever type that we were able to sequence in China in those early days here means 3 or 4 months.
Right.
In those early days is the ancestral type. So that's an assumption that we are making because there could have been other ancestral types that we haven't been able to sample that have never been reported, but we make this assumption that what has been reported is the ancestral type.
Right.
Where did this come from? Like, again, you correctly pointed out that it crossed species borders and came to humans. So the best that we can tell was that, you know, bats harbor a large number of viruses, including a progenitor of this coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, and the bat's coronavirus has a specific name. I'm not going to, it's kind of technical, RTG, et cetera, never mind that. So it has a name.
Okay.
It's a predecessor or a progenitor of this particular type of coronavirus that's infecting humans. Did it come directly from bats to humans? Likely not. There is another organism called pangolin, which again has a coronavirus that is very, very similar to the human coronavirus. So we look at, we sequence the bat coronavirus, the pangolin coronavirus, the human coronavirus, and not only the SARS-CoV-2, but as you know that there were two other outbreaks of coronaviruses, the SARS, SARS-CoV as it is called now, and MERS. And also there are four other types of coronaviruses known that are not as dangerous in various ways, neither in terms of infectivity nor in terms of killing power. So there are seven different types of known coronaviruses that infect humans, and all of them have been sequenced. And by looking at the sequence identity, we've been able to tell that the pangolin got from the bat and the human got from the pangolin. That's the best case scenario. That's the most compatible hypothesis, shall we say, most compatible hypothesis or most compatible inference given the sequence identity, the data on sequence identities of these various within species, within human species, and cross-species comparisons. So that's how we believe this particular virus evolved. We still don't know what's the last step, that what's the last mutation that happens before a virus can cross over from one species to another species. That whole process is not very well understood, the genetic changes that must take place for crossing over from one species to another.
So earlier this virus was labeled as the 2019 novel coronavirus,
yes,
right? And later the name was officially changed to SARS-CoV-2.
Yes.
Is this because this particular coronavirus is quite similar to the original SARS coronavirus and it shares a lot of similar properties in terms of its proteins and how it works and so on?
The answer is yes. Initially, when you identify a new virus, you just And its structure was known, so it was, you know, the shape of a coronavirus. It wasn't known how it came about or where it evolved from. So people quickly named it as coronavirus 2019,
right,
because it was discovered in 2019. Subsequently, when sequences were available, functional properties of the sequences or portions of the sequences became known, it became quite obvious that its closest cousin is the SARS-CoV. And so there is a nomenclature committee of these kinds of organisms, and the nomenclature committee goes back and reviews the sequence data, reviews the functional data, and eventually decided to name from, it used to be called 2019 nCoV, a novel coronavirus, to SARS-CoV-2. They didn't call it a SARS-CoV-1 because SARS-CoV was already there, SARS coronavirus,
right,
and this was then named as SARS coronavirus 2.
Okay, we can talk, I think, endlessly and have multiple episodes on how China handled the virus and how it didn't, how the world did and how it did not. But to me, one of the remarkable things is that we were able in 2019 and 2020 to get the full genetic sequence of this virus not too long after the first infection, right? And I think that has enabled the kind of research and the kind of discussions that we are even having today about how this virus is behaving, how it's evolving, what it's similar to, and so on. This would have been quite difficult even just a few years ago.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these sequencing machines have increased in their ability to quickly sequence even large genome sequences. This coronavirus has the largest, the largest genome size in terms of its length. It's 30,000 letters long.
Okay.
Among viruses, but 30,000 letters is kind of peanuts because our genome comprises 3 billion alphabets, 3 billion letters. This is only 30,000, and we can sequence, you know, many, many human genomes in a week. So it's really a cakewalk to sequence a viral genome these days. And that's the reason, because of the fact that these machines were invented that have become so high throughput that can churn out so much of data and so quickly. And so reliably and so cheaply, within days after the discovery of the virus in China, they were able to generate the first Wuhan sequence, which has now become the reference sequence of this particular coronavirus. And also, the ability to sequence has completely changed the point of view how we track epidemics. So tracking of epidemics these days essentially is done by sequences of viruses or other kinds of pathogens. The reason being that sequencing can tell us how this virus is evolving, whether a new strain, a new subtype is evolving or not. So sequencing has become the way to go about tracking an epidemic, and that was very, very well applied, very, very efficiently applied in this particular pandemic that we are now facing. So yes, the first sequence after discovery, so it was isolated from this person who was working in that seafood market, who started coughing and so on and so forth. It was isolated from him, and the sequence was brought out. That is the Wuhan 1 coronavirus sequence, which is now used as a reference sequence, which we believe is the ancestral sequence of all the other sequences that we now look at.
Okay. So in your research now, you look at this reference sequence from patient zero or patient one who's been infected by this. If I'm not mistaken, you track this all the way till the end of March, right? March 31st, and you look at...
Till 6th of April. In our paper, till 6th of April.
Okay.
But we've done more analysis since then.
Okay. So in this, how... do you start seeing the mutations? In your paper, you classify them as various strains, B1, A1A, A2A, and so on. How do you map the evolution, and how do you perhaps build an evolutionary tree of this virus?
Let me just tell you the principle to begin with, and then I can come to the nomenclature. The principle is very simple.
Right.
Let's say that you give me 100 viruses, And I say that, okay, you have given me 100 viruses. I'm going to sequence these 100 viruses. So I obtain the sequences of these 100 viruses. Each sequence is 30,000 letters long.
Right.
And then I ask myself, how do these sequences look with respect to one another? Are they exactly identical? Are they similar? Are they more or less identical? So what we do is we do pairwise comparison. So we do the first one and the second one, first one and the third one, first one and the fourth one. We take these genome sequences and start comparing them. And now what are we comparing? We are comparing letter by letter to find out what is the proportion of identity. Now we have, you know, the identity, the proportion of letters that are identical between any two pairs of these 100 viruses that you have given me.
Okay.
Armed with this data, I can ask myself, are there proportions that are small compared to some other comparisons where the proportion of differences is large? And inevitably, you find that there are some pairwise comparisons where the identity is very large or the proportion of differences is small versus other sets of pairs where you'll find that the differences are quite large or the identities are quite small. So then we can say that can we group these 100 viruses in a reasonable scientific way? And yeah, there are statistical methods of grouping sequences and grouping these kinds of data. So this is exactly what we have done. From December 24th, when the first Wuhan sample was, that individual was sampled or samples were taken from that individual and sequenced, till 6th of April, whatever was publicly available, and there were 3,636 such sequences, we looked at these sequences and asked ourselves, how many groups can we reasonably form of these 3,636 sequences? And it was quite obvious that we could form 11 different groups, and we could even find out by looking at these identities and differences sequentially what evolved after what. So not only could we say that there were 11 different types, but we could actually place them in a hierarchical fashion, which group came after which group. And so that's how we got to these 11 subtypes. And these are named. And again, there is no nomenclature committee per se of viruses. So you will also find in this literature, you will find clades or types or subtypes being called as G and L and M. And we have used words like A1, A2, AB, and so on.
Okay.
Now, there is no uniformity in the community of scientists who are doing this work. We have decided to follow one particular group, a fairly large group that's very, very active, and they have analyzed, they have also simultaneously put up the results of their analysis, etc. And this group is called Next Strain.
Right.
They not only work on this coronavirus, but they also work on other kinds of viruses.
Okay.
So this group named their clades or groups using some letters, and we decided to follow those.
Could you now tell us about how are these 11 types coming about? What is becoming more frequent across the world and more?
These are contemporary sequences, like these 3,636 sequences that we looked at, and we grouped them, and we could study the evolution over time because these sequences like are time-stamped because we know when we sampled the sequence from an individual and so on. Also, I must point out that these groups, they differ from one another because they don't have exactly the same repertoire of mutations.
Okay.
Different subsets of these sequences that we now label as groups, such as A1O or A2A and so on. So they have their own defining characteristic sets of mutations.
Okay.
Could there have been other mutations that arose and we didn't sample? Chances are there, but more likely the mutations that arose, those mutations that arise are most of the time deleterious, most of the time cause disruption of function of the virus, and so they are eliminated from the population. So lots of mutations that happen are actually not even sampled and are out of our sampling possibility.
Right.
So what we are seeing are those mutations that have survived the pressures of negative natural selection.
Right.
All right. So now we have these 10 different groups or 10 different subtypes, of which we know which is the ancestral. That's O. And if you, you know, look at the group, the timestamp of these O sequences will be the earliest timestamp. What one would expect is that these 10 different groups have arisen and they will all sort of cooperate among themselves, live, and so on and so forth. Perhaps they will specialize in some regions. Perhaps, you know, two or three different types will dominate. In another region, another two or three types will dominate, etc. So this is what one would expect of these. So these 11 types would kind of share geographical space among themselves.
Okay.
We had expected that, and then we started to look at frequencies of these different types across geographical space. And to our utter surprise, what we found was that one particular subtype of the virus, which is called E2A, started reigning supreme, and they outcompeted all the other different viral subtypes and just spread themselves far and wide at a level of frequency dominance. Now, I also must inform you that China stopped submitting sequences. I don't exactly remember the date, but sort of middle of March, China stopped submitting sequences to the public database.
Okay.
And up until March, most of the sequences in China were O. By the way, this particular subtype A2A also arose in China, and we can timestamp the A2A ancestral, the earliest A2A, and we know that it arose in China. So China harbored both O and A2A. While A2A moved on and dominated in other parts of the world, we don't know the status right now in China, whether A2A is the dominant subtype or the ancestral subtype O continues to be the dominant one. We don't know that, but in other parts of the world, wherever we go, this particular subtype, the A2A subtype, outcompeted all the others and became the dominant subtype worldwide.
And this is dominant as within the 3,600 odd samples that you've worked with, A2A now accounts for a full half of them, right?
Over half.
And though we've started getting more sequences with every month, in March, there would be an even higher proportion of all the samples that have that are available currently, right?
In April, end of April, A2A is even spreading. Spreading even more.
Wow.
So we are, our data okay. comprise until 6th of April. After April, also after 6th of April, we've been analyzing and tracking those data, and A2A frequency is still increasing. It's increasing disproportionately in Europe and North America, and less so in East Asia, meaning, you know, mostly China and Japan. But again, like I said, that whether this is sampling bias, we don't know, primarily because China has stopped submitting sequences. But other parts of East Asia, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Southeast Asia, etc.
Right.
The A2A frequency is spreading less than in Europe or North America.
Okay. So is there another limitation in how we're looking at this right now? Because this is not one study. Like, say, for example, if you or other researchers had designed a global study where you carefully picked samples at random, but in a specific way from across the infected population. Like end of March, we were at, 700,000 or so detected positive cases across the world. Now we are at a few million. Would that have made a difference in this kind of study? So here it's available data versus carefully designed randomized sample of data for the sequences.
So honestly, if you ask me, in this particular case, I really don't think it would make too much of a difference, primarily because anybody who gets infected is coming to the hospital or coming to the attention of the health workers, being sampled, and that particular virus is being sequenced. Now,
right.
It's unlikely that, you know, different strains or different subtypes of this virus are coming to the attention of the health workers more than the other subtypes. That's unlikely. If we draw randomly a whole bunch of individuals from among infecteds versus the ones who are actually being caught by health workers and being sequenced, I don't think that it would make too much of a difference. The big problem or the big difference is when countries stop submitting data. then we don't know how evolution is occurring, and that's when things can get distorted. So far, that hasn't happened except for China.
And other countries like India, we are hoping to see a lot more sequences in the coming months, right? Because
yes,
as of April 6th, there were two sequences, and then I think there were another 21 that were reported, which was, I think, Indians coming back home from abroad.
Yes. So when we submitted our paper, it was two sequences, and we made no comment about India or what's the sequence that's... what's the viral tribe that's prevalent in India with a sample of size 2? What comment can you make? But by the time our paper got accepted after peer review, and it was only about 10 days or so, 35 sequences were deposited. Today, I think it's about 50. And I understand that two other institutions are almost ready to submit another 100.
Okay.
And the government has announced 1,000 more viral sequences in the coming few months. From India, there will be many more submissions. But that also brings me to another important issue that you have indirectly raised. I said that China has stopped submitting sequences. Also, there is a disproportionate representation of sequences from various geographical regions. And so you need to take that into account as well, that there is, depending on what question you're asking, you may actually need to normalize your frequencies by, you know, the number of sequences that have been submitted from a specific geographical region. It doesn't apply to the question that we were asking in this paper, but we are also asking other kinds of questions. So one needs to also take into account the submissions or the lack of submissions from various geographical regions in order to draw some valid scientific conclusions about the epidemiology and the spread of the virus.
Certainly. We'll be back with the rest of the Pragati podcast episode after a short break. Are you liking the episode so far? Please take a few seconds to share this podcast link on social media and give us a shout out. It would mean the world to us. Welcome back to the Pragati Podcast. I'm your host, Pavan Srinath. Do listen to our episode till the end and visit thinkpragati.com or tinyurl.com/pragati136 for show notes, link to related research, articles, and more. Dr. Majumdar, let's come to this A2A strain, which I think as the Telegraph eloquently put it in their article reporting on your research, the reigning queen that is sort of emerging from this. Can you tell us about what mutations A2A has and what they might mean?
So, as I said, that each of these groups of viruses that we call as subtypes or types, the 11 different types that we have, they have some defining mutations. Those are characteristic of that particular group of viruses or type of viruses that are not possessed, either completely absent in other groups, or if they are present, they are present in low frequencies.
Okay.
So if you look at the A2A, and that's how we define these groups. There must be some distinguishing features. Otherwise, how would we even identify the different groups?
So it's not like this mutation is completely absent in other groups, but these are some of the defining mutations that make up this particular subtype.
Right. So we always aspire to be able to identify mutations that are present in one group and not present in any of the other groups. Doesn't usually happen that way. It's by frequency. So oftentimes, its frequency is very high in one subgroup and is very low in another subgroup, not that it is absent in the other subgroups.
Right.
So that's what makes this particular mutation or the frequency of the mutation characteristic of a particular group and uncharacteristic of the other group.
Right.
That's what we call as a defining mutation. For A2A, the subtype that is reigning supreme and has spread its tentacles worldwide across all geographical space, has two defining mutations, one of which we think is incidental because we find no specific major function of that. But there is one mutation where we can ascribe function. And we can even speculate in an intelligent, with some amount of wisdom that goes into understanding the functions of these different kinds of mutations. So this is a mutation that is in the spike protein. And I'll tell you what the spike protein does. I'm sure that all of your listeners would have seen a picture of the coronavirus. So it has these spikes on the surface, protruding from the surface.
And the spikes that give it the name corona in the coronavirus,
that's
right?
That's exactly right. It's the existence of the spikes that gives it the name coronavirus. This particular spike protein actually helps the virus to attach itself to the surface of a specific type of cell in the human. This SARS-CoV-2, it goes and attaches itself to a specific cell type in the lung, and then enters that particular cell and then starts to multiply within that cell. There are two stages. One is it coming and attaching itself to the cell and then tearing the cell surface open and entering the cell in order to live there and to multiply. This particular mutation that we are talking about actually helps the coronavirus of the A2A type to enable it to anchor to the surface of a human lung cell in a more efficient way compared to the other types of this virus. So it has a specific amino acid alteration from aspartic acid to glycine at the 614th amino acid position.
Of the spike protein.
Yeah, of the spike protein. And this change, amino acid change, enables it to anchor to the cell surface protein of the human lung cell. And that protein is called ACE2, expanded as angiotensin converting enzyme 2. That is expressed profusely on the surface of these lung cells. This the spike protein will then go and anchor to the ACE2 protein. And this mutation, aspartic acid to glycine mutation, helps it anchor more firmly. That's what gives it an advantage for entering the host cell.
Dr. Majumdar, is it something that we need to now start investigating a little more closely? Because there's the genomics work happening, there is sort of, you know, protein structure and function work that is happening in parallel with a host of researchers around the world. There's experimental work happening on what's happening with the spike protein and how it facilitates the entry of the virus into the human cell and what mutations could affect it, right? So here, if I'm not mistaken, and we might be getting a little into the weeds here, but the mutations happening sort of in between two domains of the spike protein, right? Between S1 and S2, where S2 sort of is the part of the protein that binds to the receptor ACE2 within the human cells. And there is also a detection of something called a furin cleavage site, which is a site that could be sort of cut or cleaved by human protein breaking enzymes. So it could play some sort of a role in how this protein gets packaged. It could play a role in changing the structure of this protein. There are many things that we hope to find better and better answers to in the coming weeks and months. Am I right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But what is known is that, like you pointed out, that the spike protein has two components, and I'm not going to use very technical language,
right?
Has two components, S1 and S2. And if S1 and S2 are joined to each other, that particular spike protein is non-functional in the sense that it doesn't gain entry into the cell.
Right.
When this S1 and S2, between S1 and S2, when there is a breakage, which we technically call as a cleavage, that cleavage also happens because of the action of some other kinds of proteins, and like you said, furin is one of those. So as long as S1 and S2 components are joined to each other, it's non-functional. But when they separate out and start functioning as S1 and S2 as independent entities, that's when they become functional. And this cleavage site is between, in the junction of S1 and S2. That's the reason why there is a functional property that's gained. And again, I mean, do we understand the entire sequence of events? Do we understand what happens when the after cleavage? We do understand quite a bit, but not, I would say, not everything. And therefore, like you correctly pointed out, there is work going on at feverish pitch. We can't experiment with humans. So human lung cell lines are being researched on, where they're infecting the cell lines with these different viruses, with the spike protein intact, with the spike protein cleaved at different places, and so on.
Okay.
So, yes, we are trying to learn more of the virus, more of the functional properties of the virus, But, from a population perspective, from an epidemiology population genetics perspective, we can look at how Darwinian selection, Darwinian evolution is acting. But Darwinian evolution is macro. When we need to get into the micro level, those are the kinds of experiments that we need to do in order to understand how positive selection for this particular subtype is operating.
Thank you so much, Dr. Majumdar. So I want to take this conversation in a couple of directions and maybe I'll go one by one. First, could I ask about how you're extending this research on the genomics analysis of the protein and the evolution, and perhaps on complementary paths, both yourself and at the NIBMG?
Yeah, I can tell you exactly what we have been pursuing, and we see light at the end of the tunnel as well. I alluded to this earlier in this conversation that even though A2A is spreading its wings all over the world, it's spreading faster and more dominantly in Europe and North America, and not so fast, and its frequency is not increasing as much in East Asia.
Okay.
So one of the questions that we had is, why is it that it is not spreading as fast in East Asia? So one can entertain all kinds of hypotheses. Being human geneticists and having known that genomes of infectious pathogens also interact with the genomes of the host, in this case, humans, and there are plenty of examples of this. So we decided to explore the human genetic angle or the host genetic angle with respect to this lack of spread in East Africa compared to Europe and North America. As you know, the ethnic composition of humans is not uniform. We've been called by various kinds of labels, Caucasians, Mongoloids, Austroasiatics, Dravidians, all kinds of labels have been put. But essentially, labels apart, there are major genetic differences, not necessarily all functional, but still, there are major genetic differences among groups of people who reside in different parts of the world. This stems from various environmental factors, various ancestral factors, and many of them also random factors. And I'm not going to expand on what these random factors may be, but also random factors that sort of modulate the frequencies of these various genes.
Right.
You were asking this question, why is there this difference in increase in prevalence of A2A between Europe, North America versus East Asia? And so what we decided to do is to look at the genetic composition of people of East Asia versus Europe and North America and ask ourselves, are there some variants that are relevant, that are candidates for interacting with the pathogen, with the viral genome, that also show huge frequency differences between North America versus East Asia? And we believe that we've been able to find a couple of these important genetic differences in the human genome that will interact or modulate the function of the viral genome. And we think that we have a reasonable understanding of why A2A is spreading in Europe and North America, but not so much in East Asia, primarily through the genomes of the people. This is, of course, nothing new. The idea is nothing new. Today or yesterday, there is an article in New York Times where they allude to genetics being responsible for the proportion of people who are dying, the proportion of infectives, and so on and so forth. So there is some thought among people, in the community of researchers of this, that host genetics may play a role. And we pursued that line, and we think that we've been able to identify a couple of variants that might be important in explaining this epidemiological and spread phenomenon.
Okay. So, Dr. Majumdar, that brings me very neatly to the next question I had, which is the news, I think, from April 29th, when the Department of Biotech here in India announced a national consortium for sequencing 1,000 viral genomes of SARS-CoV-2 over the coming year. And what was really interesting to me was that it's not just sequencing the viral genome, but also sequencing the host, not the full genome, but the exome, right? The parts of the genome which we express and make into proteins or mRNAs or various ways, along with a whole host of other data on how the patients, the clinical symptoms and more. So with that, will we be able to get a better handle on how this virus might be spreading in India, what our special vulnerabilities might be, or our beneficial adaptations might be, and so on, so that we can develop also solutions, vaccines and so on, that are tailored for India's population as well?
Yeah, that's a kind of, the last part is a kind of a long shot,
right.
A vaccine tailored towards Indians, etc. But we don't know that yet. But there are definitely certain kinds of questions that we need to ask, and the host genome may be important determinants of what we see. So what we see is that when the SARS-CoV-2 infects an individual, the clinical path is extremely variable. The clinical trajectory across individuals is extremely variable.
Right.
About 2-3% of people die. A large proportion, a fair proportion of them are asymptomatic. And those that are symptomatic have different constellations of symptoms. Of course, they all are related to lung symptoms, but still different constellations, different degrees of severity of symptoms. So what we need to understand is, why is it that it is the same virus that is infecting two people, and the two people are responding in two different ways? Of course, one possibility is that the viral load in these two people are not the same, and therefore the person in whom the viral load is more, that particular person is expressing more severe disease compared to the other person in whom the viral load may be lower. From past data of past infections of other kinds of viruses, we know that this is not a kind of a linear relationship, that the viral load and the disease severity is certainly correlated, but it's not linear. There is more to it. And so we need to understand what other factors can actually play a role in these kinds of differential clinical trajectories of patients, of individuals who are infected with SARS-CoV-2 virus. And that's one major question that needs to be answered, and that cannot be answered without sequencing both the viral genome and the genome of the person whom the virus has actively infected. So we need to look at both, correlate that with the clinical trajectory of the person who's been infected through the period of infection, look at the outcome, either the person has recovered or the person passed away, and ask, why is it that we get these different kinds of trajectories? So that's one major question that needs to be asked, which is why the Department of Biotechnology has embarked on not just sequencing the viral genome, but also looking at the host exome. Exome is about 10% of the entire genome, 10 or 12% of the entire genome, but those, like you said, are the proteins that are actually expressed. We'll see that the data must come in. The biggest challenge in India has been collecting high quality clinical data, especially if you need to track it over a period of time, let's say 21 days or so. It's very, very tedious to be able to collect diligently high quality clinical data. And especially for an infection of this magnitude, where hospitals are completely overburdened with managing the patient, collecting research data always takes a back seat.
Right.
So that, I think, is the biggest challenge. Genome sequencing, collecting the virus specimen, collecting the human host specimen, this is all cakewalk. Anybody can do it. But what is most required is diligent and hard work to collect high quality clinical data, and without that, the kind of questions that we need to ask and answer to understand the virus, the clinical aspects, the epidemiological aspects, that will not come clean unless we have high quality data throughout the period of infection.
Dr. Majumdar, thank you so much for sharing your perspectives and going behind the scenes of what makes this kind of research possible, and how we arrive at the conclusions that we do, and how we try to improve our knowledge in this fight against this pandemic. Thank you so much for joining me on the Pragati podcast.
Thank you very much for calling upon me to talk to you.
Thank you for staying with us till the end. If you have any questions or comments, do write in to podcast@thinkpragati.com. And hey, if you like the podcast and listen to us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating and a review. It'll mean a lot to us.
The Pragati podcast is available on the IVM podcast app and pretty much every other podcast app and platform. We are there everywhere.